So lesson 9 of Pioneer Missions in China. Last week we were talking about two of the home directors, or two of the directors of the China Inland Mission, the second generation leaders. And so we spent the first half talking about Henry Frost, who was the founder and the director of the North American branch of the CIM. And I told some stories about him. My lasting impression of Henry Frost is him in desperation in his upstairs office in Toronto, crying out to God because they have just they're at the bottom of the barrel when it comes to their finances. And having that passing thought, I wish Mr. Taylor were here, and how human that is, and yet how the Lord gave him faith to himself, latch hold of God's promises, that he's not just Hudson Taylor's God, he's my God too. And helped him through that crisis of faith. And then we talked about D.E. Haast, who is Hudson Taylor's successor, who comes to the reins in 1901, one of the Cambridge Seven. And my lasting impression of D.E. Haast is him walking the circuit in the courtyard of the Shanghai headquarters, where he would be praying out loud by the hour for every one of the 1,200 missionary families that the CIM had in the early 1900s, the missionaries and their children. He did this so regularly that he could just do this without even having a list to remind him. He just knew. He knew of their stations, of their places. He was familiar with their prayer requests, and he would just walk the circuit out loud, and he would always choose someone to walk with him to keep him accountable, a silent prayer partner. Sometimes it would be a visiting missionary who was in Shanghai to convalesce. Sometimes it would be a young person who was on his way into inland China. Sometimes it would be a child. There's a really enduring, really a neat story in the later on in his biography about a little child going up to him, and the parents are like, no, don't interrupt Mr. Haast, right? And Mr. Haast, and he just... He just completely naturally, right in the middle of his prayer, reaches his hand down, gives his finger to the little 4-year-old girl, and they started walking. And she just walked with him silently as he prayed. So that's kind of my image of Haast. Well, Haast came to the leadership of the CIM in a time of crisis, 1901. And if you're familiar with the history of the day, you might recall that that's only a year after the horrors of what we call the Boxer Rebellion. And so today I want to talk to you a little bit about the Boxer Rebellion and about one classic work that came out of the Boxer Rebellion that I have two copies of, one abridged version and one full-length version that you might want to think about reading and seeing the blessing of. So let me just kind of get a background to the history here. There was always an anti-foreign sentiment in China, partly because of their millennia of isolation, partly because of the teachings of Confucius, partly the fault of the Western nations and the abuses of colonialism and the opium trade that we have talked about and the egregious taking advantage of the Chinese people through the opium trade. And so there was always this undercurrent of anti-foreign sentiment. But in the late 19th century, 1890s or so, it really rose to a fever pitch. And there were two or three reasons for it. First of all, there was a war between China and Japan, where China was defeated by Japan. It was a humiliating defeat for China. And one of the reasons that China lost is because the Western powers came into this on the side of Japan, attempting to weaken China for economic purposes. And so there was the anti-foreign sentiment from that. Another reason was that the mid-1890s was a time of severe famine in northern China. just like there was a famine in northern China in the 1870s, and we talked about that several weeks ago with David Hill's ministry and his famine relief, and that's the context that Pastor Xi was converted out of. There was a terrible famine in the mid-1890s, and according to Confucianism, those kind of natural disasters are based on, you know, unfaithfulness to the ancestors and that kind of stuff. And so the Christians around would be blamed for things like no rain or for floods. I mean, they would be blamed for any kind of natural disaster. It was the foreigner's fault. It was the fault of the foreigner's gods. And then there was, this is hard to get information on, but you do see in some of the literature, there was a very anti-Roman Catholic kind of a sentiment to the Boxer Rebellion. And when it came to the Boxer Rebellion and the reported casualties, there were 10 times as many Roman Catholics killed as Protestants. There was something about the Roman Church in the late 1800s that had really gotten, the Chinese had gotten a very bad taste in their mouth for the priests and the diocese and the different things going on with the Catholic Catholics, and so there was that going on as well. So there was this group of anti-foreigners in the 1890s. They called themselves the Righteous and Harmonious Fists. So they were specially trained in martial arts, so the fists. And then English-speaking people translating this into English and seeing their tactics called them the Boxers, the Boxers. And so, Boxer Rebellion. It began as isolated riots, but in January of 1900, the Empress began to sympathize with their cause. There's this lady, she's named the Empress Dowager. And once she began to be sympathetic with the cause of the Boxers, of the Righteous and Harmonious Fists, the Western nations began to get nervous about this because of all of their holdings economically in China, and they couldn't have rioting. That would upset the trade. And so they began to meddle, which only fueled the fire of anti-foreign sentiment when they begin to meddle. And so on June 21st, 1900, the Empress Dowager declared war on all foreign powers, both military powers that were in the coasts, like Britain and Portugal and France and such, but also foreigners living within the realm. And basically, it was a free-for-all. You're allowed to kill foreigners. In fact, you'd be doing your nation a service if you kill foreigners. It was open season on any non-Chinese people. 4 days later, it was posted in all of the post offices in China. Foreign relations are reckless and oppressive, disrespectful to the gods and oppressive to the people. The righteous people will burn and kill. Your judgments from heaven are about to come. Turn from the fall, turn from the failure and revert to the true. Is it not benevolence to exhort you, people of the Christian religion, be quick and reform? If you do your duty, you are a good people. If you do not repent, there will be no opportunity for second thoughts. For this purpose is this proclamation put forth. Let all comply with it. And so a notice for Chinese converts. Did they better recant their religion, or they're going to get caught up in this as well? 2 weeks after the Empress Dowager's proclamation of open season on all foreigners, there was this governor of Shanxi I'm not going to pronounce his name, I'm not going to attempt to pronounce his name and butcher it, but the governor of Shanxi, who gets the nickname the Butcher of Shanxi. And on July 9th, 1900, this man lured to the capital of Shanxi a whole bunch of foreigners under pretext of keeping them safe from the Boxers. And then he decapitated them. 44 missionaries including women and children, lured to the capital and then their heads taken off by the butcher of Shanxi. And then over the course of the summer, it was just a tragic, tragic end to many people's lives. There were 189 Protestant missionaries died. The China Inland Mission lost 58 adults and 21 children, so by far the lion's share of that 189 was from the China Inland Mission. That makes sense because they had so many missionaries in China. And there's the day for that riot that I just told you about. They estimate that there were 2,000 Protestant Christians killed during the Boxer Rebellion. They also estimate something like 20,000 Roman Catholics killed. A lot of times those reports are from Roman Catholic sources, and so you wonder about the numbers, and because, you know, they saint all these people and everything and make sense out of them. But it was, you know, 2,000 Protestant Christians is the number that's often given. So a terrible, terrible summer, 1900. Out of this great tragedy comes a classic work in the history of the China Inland Mission called A Thousand Miles of Miracle. And you've heard me talk about this before. I used it as an illustration when we were in Romans chapter 5 and talking about the love of God poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit. So let me tell you the story of this family and their escape from Shanxi. There's a man. His name was Archibald Glover. There he is. He's at the time of the escape. He's 41 years old. He had gone to China 4 years prior to the Boxer Rebellion to work with Stanley Smith. Stanley Smith was one of the Cambridge Seven. And he was the spokesman and probably the most gifted of the Cambridge Seven. And he had established a mission station in Luan, in Shanxi, in southern Shanxi, and A.E. Glover, Archibald Glover, had gone to serve with him as his partner. His wife is named Flora. Flora is 28 years old at the time of the Boxer Rebellion. They have two children. Their children are named Headley and Hope. Headley, at the time of their escape, is 4. Hope is 3. On June 9th, 1900, they began to hear of the growing unrest, and they had a very difficult decision ahead of them of whether to flee or not. And you can imagine that kind of decision, how difficult that would be. Fleeing, number one, didn't guarantee anything. You feel a whole lot more safe at home than you do out in the road trying to get home. And they are 1,000 miles from the coast. And number two, fleeing and leaving all these Chinese Christians behind without their pastor seems very, you know, you seem like a traitor doing this. It's like, you know, go down with the ship kind of a mentality. So it was an awful decision for them to make. But Archibald did decide, through prayer and the leading of the Lord, to go ahead and attempt an escape out of southern Shanxi. And so they decided first that they would try to go northeast to modern-day Beijing, called, you know, Peking back in those days. So they were going to try to go to Beijing, to the capital, and get, you know, go to the embassy or something there. So they attempted to go northeast, and that proved to be impossible. There was no way that they were going to get through the roads and the towns in order to get to Beijing. So they doubled back. So the first couple weeks of their trip was fruitless. They had to double back, and they decided to go south, 400 miles overland south to what they called in those days Hankow, but now has the name Wuhan. And so you've heard of Wuhan before. Everybody's heard of Wuhan. And so they're going to escape to Wuhan. That was the closest safe city. And it was 400 miles overland from where they were in southern Shanxi. So here's a map of China with 3 red dots. Okay, so they are in southern Shanxi, so they're here. and they're going to go to Wuhan, and then there's a river going from Wuhan to Shanghai, the Yellow River. And so they can just, once they get to Wuhan, they're good. And they can get on a boat, a steamer, and they can make it to Shanghai for safety. And Wuhan is a safe place. And so basically, the story of the book is 1,000 miles of miracle, because you add up this little, they went like this, and then they went down, and they went like this. That's 1,000 miles. But the real harrowing part of the adventure is the 400 miles between Luan and Wuhan, the Luan and Wuhan. 67 days they were on the road. And so think about this distance here, 400 miles. Okay, so think about going from here to Charlotte, North Carolina. So basically the Appalachian Trail. Okay? Only they would have been glad to have the isolation of that Appalachian Trail. What's going on is everywhere that they are discovered, they are called foreign devils, and they are attempting to be murdered. And everybody thinks they would be doing the gods and doing China service if they were murdered. They have no protection, no rights whatsoever. They're traveling by what you call a mule liter. And so can you imagine this way of transportation? You have two mules with poles in between, and then this thing on the poles where you can fit two people plus their stuff. And so Archibald and Headley would be in one, and Flora and Hope would be in the other, along with a third person who went with them, a single missionary lady named Miss Gates. Flora was 6 months pregnant for this escape. She's at the same point in her pregnancy as my wife is for these 67 days in something like this on good days, or something like this on other days, a Chinese wheelbarrow where you've got this giant wheel and you're sitting on the sides. And you can imagine on mountain roads what that would feel like after a little while and the jolting of that. And they're springless. It's just an axle, and there's no rubber here. It's just a wooden or steel. It's a steel wheel with no spring and no rubber, and you're on rocky mountain roads. You imagine that would be like for Flora. And everywhere they went, it was just danger after danger and narrow escapes by God's answered prayer. So I have told you the story once, and I'm sure you forget it, but it's recorded. You can go back and listen to it. When I preached on Romans 5:3, I think it is, about them being up on the top of that hill in a little divot in the top of the hill and baking under the sun, and having no water for a full day. I told you that story one time already. Let me read you another story from their adventures and God's grace in their lives. So I have two copies of 1,000 Miles. There's the full-length one, the yellow one that a lot of you purchased after I talked about it. I also have an abridged copy, which is about half the size of this one. So both are excellent. I'll read you the non-abridged version of this. All right, so it's a desperate situation. They have been captured. They've been found out. They've been captured. They are in a room with 5 jailers. The room is 12 by 20. Okay, 12 by 20. And there are 10 human beings in this room, because there's the 5 of them and there's 5 jailers. It was an immensely hot midsummer night. The room, in a size of 20 feet by 12, was very low and filthy. There was no ventilation, and for the door, the only real avenue by which air could reach us, it was fast barred and locked. The fire, which had been in use all day for cooking, was kept in all night. So Imagine the smoke and the heat. This is July, and it's hot in China. And there were 10 persons in the room. Moreover, the atmosphere reeked with the sickly fumes of opium blown from the pipes of the five jailers, whose forms were revealed by the opium lamp lying stark naked around us. And so it's so hot, and you know, it's Chinese custom, so these five guys, and they're just sleeping without their clothes on in this vermin-infested room. To add to these miseries, the bed, and when they say bed, it's a brick bed. Okay, so the brick bed was infested with vermin, whose depredations were reinforced by the attacks of mosquitoes. Our lying down was not to sleep, but to watch and pray. At any moment, the death summons might come, and we must be prepared. Now and again, during the night, the guards would exchange a few words, but beyond this, and an occasional looking over to us to make sure all was right, nothing took place. The long, weary hours were spent in the light of God's countenance and in the multitude of our thoughts within us. Thy comforts refreshed our souls. Then at daybreak, there was a riot outside of the city, outside of the holding place where they were, of all the people of the town demanding their immediate execution, kill the foreign devils. We knew all the crisis had come. Nothing but the direct and immediate intervention of God himself could deliver us out of their hands. At this moment, the promise was born in powerfully upon my heart. Call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver thee, and thou shalt glorify me. My faith was strengthened to take hold of it and to plead it with God as a promise to which he had pledged his name for the present hour of our trouble. Our part was to call upon him, and realizing as we did that the assigned cause of their rage against us was the long-continued drought, we were moved under the impulse of the promise to make a united cry to God to interfere for his great namesake on our behalf by sending rain enough to satisfy the need of these poor sufferers, and because of our extremity, to send it now. Accordingly, kneeling upon the brick bed, we poured out our hearts before him in Chinese so that the jailers might know exactly what we were doing and what we were asking. Fools, to suppose that out of a cloudless sky, as brazen as ever before, with every prospect of another day of devouring heat, rain could fall and fall at once. Had not the guards already caught up the cry without and warned us that our hour was come and that there was not the faintest indication of rain, nor would there be till our blood was shed? The contemptuous incredulity with which they listened showed what was in their heart. How long we continued in prayer, I cannot tell. I only know that scarcely had we risen from our knees when the windows of heaven were opened, and down upon the howling mob swept the sudden fury of a torrential flood of waters. In a few seconds, the street was empty. Not a sound was to be heard but the swish of the rushing rain. Oh, I can tell you, dear reader, the words, "God is a very present help in trouble," became a living great reality to us in the moment of doom. In so marvelous a manifestation of his love, we found a true manifestation of himself. His very presence could not have been more real to us in the prison room if we had seen it with our eyes. The throb of the heavy splash of the waters without, was the echo in our ears of his voice, a music of God's own setting to the new song which he had now put in our mouth. From that vile den went up the song of Moses and the song of the Lamb. Great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. The prayer of the poor destitute was once more turned into praise, and the prison of our sighs into the temple of his song, who alone giveth songs in the night, even thanksgiving to our God. And he goes on. because, of course, they're still in jail. And so the next night, the jailers try to poison them, and with a drug that they have in the room, wafting into the room to kill them in their sleep. And for some strange reason, quote unquote, Miss Gates never went to sleep. It didn't work on her. The rest of them were like nodding off, and she was keeping them awake. And so it's just one day after another like that, where they're absolutely at their extremity. 67 days later, they make it to Wuhan. And when they get to Wuhan, they get there just in time for Flora to give birth to her baby. And they named the baby Faith, and it passed away within a week because Flora did have dysentery for this entire time as well. So she's pregnant with dysentery, gives birth to Faith. Faith dies within a couple days. And then once they get to Shanghai, 2 weeks later, Flora does die as well. So she's one of those 158 missionaries, CIM missionaries, that die at the Chinese Boxer Rebellion. So there's God's providence and good working through those tragedies can be an encouragement. So they get these two books here, 1,000 Miles of Miracle in China, Abridged and Unabridged, and recommend them to you. Let's prepare now for our morning prayer time.